Listening Library presents 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne. Read for you by James Frayne.
Introduction. The Ardent Blasphemers by Ray Bradbury. Consider America, first of all the new breed of nations. Consider America, a nation because of its newness, ardent in its blasphemy. Set in motion by the centrifuge of the great wheel of the Industrial Revolution, this people flung themselves across sea prairies to stand on New England rimrock and fling themselves yet on across land prairies. Shocking other ages, they blasphemed down the meadows and over hills as ancient as the memory of Jerusalem. Consider America, her fire dragon locomotives huffing out vast devil bursts of fluming spark, setting the lion grass afire as they went. Come to a forest, cut it down. Come to a mountain, quarry it to pebbles. Skip the pebbles across God's lakes. Build new mountains, finally upright and ornamented with man's prideful encrustations. Then run men up and down elevator shafts to a heaven no longer believed in, from a hell much better ignored. Consider the authors who lived in and with these men and wrote to channel this blasphemy, express it in symbols about which such men could enthuse like devil children. With a new nation being dreamt to life, set to rights with fabulous new toys, the uneasy dreamers cast about and came up with two most ardent blasphemers. Herman Melville, Jules Verne. American authors, both. Melville the New Englander and Verne the Frenchman, you say. Americans both? American, yes, in their newness and their attack upon the universe and this world rolling through that universe. Another nation could have been American first. The seeds of man's mechanical reaction to nature were cast forth first in England and France. But the flowering of what other ages might have considered an insidious tree was in this raw nation under God, which would soon ask him to move over, jump aside, step down. We might not even ask his pardon while we scourged the mineral gut, packed once holy echoes in electronic boxes to deal them forth commercially, split atoms as handily as peas, and dared God to answer back in equal thunders. I say another nation could have done this, but the accidents of time and circumstance dubbed us unholy first. Others follow us in our sacrilege, the Japanese and his insect-clicking camera, the Frenchman flung about by our LP jive, the Italian hopping Rhone's hills on angry adaptations of our motorbikes. The sacrilege was inevitable. Once set, the wheel invented by some fine fool of a first blasphemer in motion just beyond old Egypt, and it rolls up in the late 80s of our time such dust clouds as would dim the bright visage of any spoiled god. Wheels within wheels within wheels rolled forth upon our land and, later, way in the middle of our outraged god's air. And being firstest with the mostest, we not only did, but read, and having read, did more. And Jules Verne was our text and testament, followed close by packs of evil boys, like Tom Swift and his flying machine, plus his AC/DC IBM power-circuited grandmother. "I sing the body electric," cried Whitman. And Americans wound tight their robot devices and set them free to gnaw ugliness across the territories which now, very late, we must clean up after. But let us go back to our literary beginnings. Why, in introducing you to this book by Jules Verne, do I summon forth the lunar name of Herman Melville? What relation do I see between a Frenchman, benevolent as a good uncle in his eccentricities, and strange cousin Herman, who some thought best kept in America's attic? From the viewpoint of Gothic times peering ahead at the tidal wave of the future, let me set up these two men. God, after all, was in his heaven a long while, and things went well for him, if not his children, upon earth. Those born but to die inhabited his churches, and if they questioned, questions were best kept mum in one's mouth, or like gum behind the ear. But send these god-doting children free from Europe, strew and scrabble them across a whole continental surprise, hand them commotions and contraptions of steam and whiffling iron, and they pant up frenzies of revenge against God for having maltreated them down the eons. Out of questions suddenly posed and needs suddenly found most needful, as the steam blew off and the proud dust settled, we found Mad Captain Ahab, Mad Captain Nemo, Moby Dick, the Great White Whale, Nautilus, the whale-seeming submarine, first of its hidden and terrific sort, soaring through sea meadows among sinner sharks and true leviathans. Look how these two evil men implement their blasphemy. Call me Ishmael. So Melville strikes forth on his search for Moby Dick. In his first chapter we find, why upon your first voyage as a passenger did you yourself feel such a mystical vibration when first told that you and your ship were now out of sight of land? Why did the old Persians hold the sea holy? Why did the Greeks give it a separate deity, an own brother of Jove? Surely all this is not without meaning. And still deeper, the meaning of that story of Narcissus, who, because he could not grasp the tormenting, mild image he saw in the fountain, plunged into it and was drowned. But that same image we ourselves see in all rivers and oceans, it is the image of the ungraspable phantom of life. And this is the key to it all. Why does Ishmael go to sea? Chief among these motives was the overwhelming idea of the great whale himself. Such a portentous and mysterious monster aroused all my curiosity. Then the wild and distant seas where he rolled his island bulk, the undeliverable nameless perils of the whale, these, with all the attending marvels of a thousand Patagonian sights and sounds, helped to sway me to my wish. By reason of these things, then, the whaling voyage was welcome. The great floodgates of the wonder world swung open, and in the wild conceits that swayed me to my purpose, two and two there floated into my inmost soul endless processions of the whale, and mid most of them all, one grand hooded phantom like a snow hill in the air. In 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Jules Verne starts thus. The year 1866 was marked by a strange event, an unexplainable occurrence which is undoubtedly still fresh in everyone's memory. Several ships had recently met at sea an enormous thing, a long, slender object which was sometimes phosphorescent, and which was infinitely larger and faster than a whale. Verne continues, the facts concerning this apparition agreed closely with one another as to the structure of the object or creature in question, the incredible speed of its movements, the surprising power of its locomotion, and the strange life with which it seemed endowed. If it was a member of the whale family, it was larger than any so far classified by scientists, but it did exist. There was no denying this fact any longer, and considering the natural inclination of the human brain toward objects of wonder, one can understand the excitement produced throughout the world by this supernatural apparition. So two books begin. Both set somewhat the same tone. Both strike chords that may recur within the framework of the book to follow. Yet swiftly we perceive rank differences. We soon know that while Uncle Jules is mostly gently mad, Cousin Herman is beyond the pale. We set sail with Ishmael, who, unknowing, is in the clutches of wild Ahab, seeking some universal truth shaped to a monster all frightful white named Moby Dick. We set sail almost simultaneously with Professor Aronnax and Ned Land and Conseil on the Abraham Lincoln in search of this other mystery which, in every big city, became the fashion. It was sung about in cafes, derided in newspapers, and discussed on the stage. Scandal sheets had a marvelous opportunity to print all kinds of wild stories. Even ordinary newspapers, always short of copy, printed articles about every huge imaginary monster one could think of, from the white whale, the terrible Moby Dick of the far north, to the legendary Norse Kraken. So we suspect that Uncle Jules has touched minds somewhere down the line with Cousin Herman. But without any real exchange or super blending of madness, Mr. Verne will go his own way with his educated vengeance, leaving Melville with his
Sample complete. Ready to continue?